Sisters, brothers, friends, comrades, thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you today. Immediately after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, George Bush announced that the war on terror was the first war of the 21st century, conveniently forgetting, for example, that at the time the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo had already led to the deaths of some 3.5 million people. And those sorts of wars, those sorts of crises, to which we could add the present emergency in Darfur and Sudan, the wars that occurred in Liberia and Sierra Leone and so on, I think lead many people to feel that even though they are suspicious of the motives of the great powers, that they must do something in order to sort out the real suffering that's happening of people on the African continent. That even people who are opposed to the American war in Iraq, for example, feel that something has to be done, that these people ought to use their power in order militarily to sort out conflicts that are going on in Africa. And often this is phrased in a way that says the reason they do not do this is because of their racism, because there are no crucial mineral resources for them, and that they are refusing to take action when they could go in and sort out these places. I want to argue that such activities will only take place when the interests of the imperialist powers themselves are at stake, and only when it fits in with their global worldview. That imperialism is of a piece. There is not a nice America or Britain that intervenes in Africa, and a nasty imperialism of America and Britain that intervenes in Iraq. They are continuity and a totality of the same thing. That imperialism fights on many fronts. One of the sharpest examples at the moment is the way that Paul Wolfowitz, one of the hardest men inside the American administration, has been installed as the leader of the World Bank. That is a continuity of the program of Iraq in a different form. The program of imperialist power, of the control of the world by the American multinationals, held not through purely military mechanisms, but also through financial mechanisms as well. That the World Bank will be used to hammer home the same agenda in a non-militaristic fashion. And if those stand up against it, then the Iron Fist will stand behind it in order to make sure that the agenda is imposed by sharper mechanisms. I therefore want to argue that to think that military intervention by the great powers can ever bring about humanitarian improvement is an illusion that can lead to support for forces that are opposed to the sorts of things that we want to see, the changes we want to see in the world, the empowerment of people in Africa, the abolition of poverty, the end of conflict, that none of those aims will be put forward by the support of armed intervention by the great powers on the African continent. And I want to argue that if those things do occur, they are part of a continuum of Western involvement that began with what? The 16th century, the attacks by the Portuguese upon the east coast of Africa, the British slaving expeditions on the west coast of Africa that gathered pace in the appalling atrocities of the Atlantic slave trade that saw 12 million taken across to the Caribbean and the United States, that then led to colonialism and the carving up of the African continent, the way that the Cold War divided Africa between the great powers, and then the structural adjustment programs beggared Africa in the modern era, that there will be a continuity of that, not a break from it. And I want to take a hard case, because it's easy to talk about the simple case. I can talk about the Somali intervention example, where you all know the Americans succeeded only in uniting the country against themselves, empowering warlords that they'd gone there to dispossess, and of making the situation worse. That's an easy example. I want to take a difficult example, the example of Rwanda. Because many of you will have seen the film Hotel Rwanda, a very powerful film, in many ways a very good film. But I think that raises very strongly the feeling that they should have intervened more. There should have been more military people intervening in Rwanda. You know, for those who are not familiar with Rwanda, in April 1994, in a period of 100 days, some 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were slaughtered in a genocide launched by the Rwandan government, one of the most appalling atrocities of the modern era. There's a strong feeling that there should be more military intervention in Rwanda. And many good people feel that when they see the pictures of what the UN did, because of course you know the UN pulled out as soon as the genocide began. The UN forces that were there to monitor the peace accord that was being negotiated in Rwanda, as soon as the atrocities began, 90% of the troops were pulled out. The force was reduced to 270. And Madeleine Albright, the US Secretary of State at the time, the woman who's famous for saying that the deaths of 500,000 children in Iraq was a price worth paying, wanted all of the troops out, even the 270 she regarded as too many, and studiously avoided using the word genocide in all her proclamations because that would have triggered intervention by the UN. And in that circumstance, people feel Rwanda needed intervention. Good people feel that. I understand why people feel that. But the problem with Rwanda did not come from too little intervention, but from far too much intervention by the great powers, over a period not of 100 days, but a period of 100 years. Because the systematic conflict between Hutu and Tutsi was not a feature of pre-colonial Rwanda, for example. The very complicated society of Rwanda, I haven't time to go into it, was one that was shattered by first by German colonialism and then Belgian colonialism. It was them who transformed trans-ethnic identities of local significance, of Hutu and Tutsi, into the inability of people to move from one group to another, changed them into racial categories. It was the Belgians who introduced the identity cards, the identity card system, which was used in order to decide who lived and who died at the roadblocks in April 1994. Because anyone who's been to Rwanda knows that in most cases you can't tell by looking at people whether they're Hutu or Tutsi. It was the identity cards that were used to decide whether people lived or died. And that was a Belgian invention to impose those on people. It was colonialism that privileged some sectors and beggared others and created feelings of resentment and tension which had never existed in that previous period. And much more than that, it was the great powers whose say-so would have been necessary in order for intervention to begin that fueled the precise nature of the genocide during that period of 1994. That all of them, practically all the great powers, sold arms to the despotic and right-wing Hutu government of Rwanda in the period immediately before the genocide. That it was the actual military intervention by France and Belgium that prevented the defeat of the Hutu government in 1990 when there was a rebellion against it. That the machetes used by the Interahamwe squads during the genocide were imported from China, one of the great Security Council powers. The Kalashnikovs that were used were imported from Russia, another of the great powers. That the armed forces of Rwanda were trained and supported and armed by France, another of the great imperial powers. That the British and Americans, the other two Security Council powers, also poured armaments into the Great Lakes region of Africa, which fueled the tension further and led to the sense that society was collapsing. And even when the genocide had begun, those great powers did intervene. But their intervention was to make the genocide worse. That it was the French government who sent troops in Operation Turquoise to support the Hutu militias, which had carried out much of the killing. You remember that Mitterrand was the Prime Minister of France, the President of France at the time, and the Interahamwe squads became known as Mitterahamwe in Rwanda because they would drive along with a French jeep with a huge tricolour on it. People in hiding would come out thinking that their saviours had arrived, only to be butchered by the squads who were coming with the French troops. That this was the reality of what intervention meant. And actually, intervention is much deeper than that as well. That intervention also included the creation of the economic conditions which led to the tension in Rwanda. That the world system, created, policed and monitored by the great powers, led to the beggaring of Rwandan society and to economic collapse. Why did the genocide happen in Rwanda? It's a complicated question, but the essential nature of it, of why ordinary people could be turned against their neighbours, not all of them, but some of them turned against their neighbours, was because that their whole society was falling apart in front of them and they could be made to turn upon scapegoats. Not an African phenomenon, happens on the streets of Glasgow now, happens on the streets of London. It's encouraged by politicians not only in Africa, it's encouraged by politicians in Westminster just as much. Asylum seekers, immigrants, the crime, youth and so on. The scapegoating of people is something that is common to ruling classes across the globe. That's what happened in Rwanda. And the reason why people could be made to feel like that was because the whole world was falling apart around them, that they couldn't send their kids to school, there wasn't enough to eat, there was a great land hunger, there were jobs falling apart. The whole of the world seemed to be cracking around them, and it was easy to find a scapegoat. And the reason why that economic crisis happened was because of the collapse of world commodity prices. The pinstripe boys on the metal exchanges in London sold the tin futures short, and peasants 6,000 miles away died because of it, because of the structural adjustment programs that were implemented by the IMF and the World Bank in the early 90s, which meant, for example, that people had to pay for hospitals, hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs, privatisation was pushed through, food subsidies were lost, and so on. The whole of Rwandan society was breaking apart. And that's a form of intervention. Intervention is not just about people with guns. It's also about the creation and continuation of a world economic system which breaks societies in Africa and other parts of the third world and hurls them into chaos. And therefore, for us, that is all of a piece. I don't believe you can say they're nasty one moment when they create the World Bank and the IMF structural adjustment programs, but we must ask them to intervene militarily in order to sort out these problems. They will only do it if it's in their own interests and for their own interests, not in the interests of the ordinary people of Africa or anywhere else. And therefore, just to conclude, there are, of course we know this, horrific and appalling wars and emergencies in Africa caused by the system created by the West and also by those leaders in Africa who go along with them. But when faced with those, our answer should not be to call for military intervention by the West, but to show solidarity with people in Africa who are fighting back against the conditions that create that, and also to demand of our own governments, not military intervention, but simple measures that could improve those situations. The West, Blair and Brown, talked about Darfur, for example. I wonder how many refugees from Sudan would have been allowed through Dover or through Prestwick Airport had they turned up to demand their rights to silence in Britain. To speak of the crisis in Africa, but not to open the gates of Britain to people fleeing those crises is gross hypocrisy and connivance with the murder that goes on in Africa. So that's one simple demand. Allow in immigrants and asylum seekers, not try to make them easy political capital in a general election. Secondly, the dropping of 100% debt cancellation without restrictions is an important way of preventing the collapse of societies in Africa, which leads to tension and scapegoating and the feeling that war is a natural result of that. War is not a natural thing in Africa any more than it is in Europe or anywhere else. It's caused by very real economic and political questions, which are fueled particularly by things like the debt crisis. And thirdly, that to say they should stop subsidising and supporting and encouraging the arms trade, which leads to more people in Africa thinking that this is the way to do it. And of course, if you have imperialist world powers who bestride the world using military mechanisms in order to inflict their interests upon the rest of the world, that is a model that will also ripple through the rest of the world. That the Iraq war is a model and an example that is taken up by ruling classes in other parts of the world, because that seems to be the way in which you get your interests forced through against other powers. For that reason, I think we should be against military intervention. It will not be humanitarian intervention. Instead, we should demand the things that I've mentioned of our governments and stand with people in Africa who are fighting for real freedom and a real solution to the problems. Thank you.